Welcome to the Africa Speaking Podcast. The podcast discusses critical issues about the African continent. It is brought to you by Toyeza Communications in Nairobi. My name is Kimani Njogu. So again, welcome to Africa Speaking Podcast and the conversation on constitution making in Kenya. You've been in this journey, Willie, since the beginning. I mean, it's amazing that your whole life, from being a young person, being a student, being a lecturer, being a lawyer, an advocate of the High Court, all the way to the Supreme Court and working with civil society, you've really spent your life and energies around helping Kenyans, you know, realize a constitution that actually serves ordinary citizens. And there have been people who have said, if there is one moment that opened up opportunities for Kenya, it was the 2002 elections and the entry of the NARC government. Do you think that it was that transformative? Was it that transformative, that moment?
I think people have to see it as the government that brought down the Moi dictatorship.
Yes.
Okay? Because even people say that Moi did not support Uhuru at all. He felt safe with, you know, Kibaki. But it has to be called transformative because you have a Kanu dictatorship that, you know, is now hold into almost from 63. And the resistance is the one that we use as a marker of transformation. That there was this push, the Kanu dictatorship caves in, you know, Kibaki comes in, and of course, Kanu sons and daughters. But it's true because NARC comes up with promises of, you know, a new constitution. A lot of civil society guys become part of that government, whether it's Mukisa Kitui,
the Kibwana,
Kiraitu Murungi, Akina Orengo, you know. There's a group of civil society people that, you know, join that, you know, government. And then the comprehensive constitution process then it starts in, you know, 2003. Slows down a bit when Kijana Wamalwa dies, you know.
Vice president.
As vice president. But still, Bomas, you know, is able to come up with, you know, a draft. You know.
But of course, that is preceded by the Yash Palga-led constitutional review, you know, draft, which then now gets subjected to the Bomas conference, isn't it?
Yeah, there is that constitution from 98. You know, there is a consensus that there will be, you know, a comprehensive, you know, constitution, although Raila, you know, is pushing the parliamentary route. And then the Ufungamano says, no, you know, we want this other route. That's what Guy brought together, the civil society strategy and the parliamentary strategy. And then what happens? The Bomas draft is the one that is mutilated, you know.
In Naivasha, to generate now the WACO.
Yeah, the WACO, which is rejected.
Which is rejected at the referendum.
2005. Yeah, 2005 rejected and, you know, back to, you know, square one.
Would you then say that the idea of a mandatory referendum, which was, I think, in the Constitutional Review Act 2004, which basically says, look, the only way a new constitution will be enacted is through a referendum. Was that a radical?
It's radical because it's the one that you see in Article 1 of the 2010 Constitution about sovereignty of the people, and that a referendum, you know, means that Kenya as a people, you know, give themselves that constitution and for future, you know, generations. it also reflects their participation, you know, although you can interrogate that participation, you know, during the constitution making processes and so forth. But the referendum obviously is for giving it final approval, you know, in terms of the sovereignty of the people, because they have to, you know,
they have to accept it.
Mm. One thing I should have said is that when you talk about the 2010 constitution, it borrowed from very many drafts, not just the CKIC draft.
Correct.
The human rights groups did their model constitution in 1994.
The Kenya to Itakayo.
Yes. Mm. Okay. And then there were others done by NCCK.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and ordinary Kenyans also wrote, you know, drafts and so forth.
And position papers. There were drafts and also position papers,
yes,
which were then presented,
yes,
as positions with,
yes,
regard to particular issues and particular concerns.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, and that's an aspect of robust public participation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the committee of experts really had, you know, a lot of material to go through. And because it was very conflictional, that's why they took this route of basically saying the constitution, the judiciary will sort out the conflicts
between the various sections. Yeah.
Yes.
So Kenyans reject the draft that's presented to them in 2005 in a referendum. Once the constitution is rejected, we have the expurging of certain elements from government.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
By Kibaki. And then 2007, we have the violence. Does that violence kind of almost... Does it accelerate the process of constitution making?
I think so.
Mm.
I think so. The Kofi Annan peace process, you know, came up with those pillars.
Mm.
And one clearly was, a new constitution. You know, it happened.
Mm.
And that's why the Kenya, you know, the 2010 constitution is not just a ceasefire document.
Mm.
It has a background of very peaceful, you know, negotiations over efforts, decades,
yeah,
and efforts, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
But I think the trigger was the violence.
So that's why we talk about the continuities.
Yes.
Yeah, the continuities. I mean, we have to always historicize, isn't it?
Yes.
We have to look at not just one element as having contributed to the process of making our constitution, but actually as a continuum.
Yeah, it's a continuum.
It's a continuum.
Yeah, and the Nusu Mukate government, or, you know, Raila becoming prime minister, that particular government after what, 2007?
Yes, 2007. Yeah.
You know, there was no way they were going to disengage the Kofi Annan, you know, peace process, you know. So they went back to to set up this committee of experts to finalize it.
I was talking with a very active member of civil society and a religious leader at that.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that the Kofi Annan Kenya National Dialogue and Reconciliation process really stopped a revolution from taking place in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that it took us back in terms of our transformation as a country. Now, coming from a religious leader, I found that interpretation of the Kenya National Dialogue and Reconciliation process to be very radical, a very radical position to say, look, we didn't need Kofi Annan to do this mediation. This thing would have continued and therefore forced a very radical socio-economic and political change in this country. And of course, my concern with that was the possibility of degenerating into anarchy. So we got into this discussion. I don't know whether you have any reflection on that.
Yeah, unless of course the this religious leader, you know, had what we call a vanguard waiting, because the revolutions don't just happen. You know, maybe what he meant was that we were going to have an uprising, And just like what we would have been comparable to the Arab Spring.
Yes.
You know, because there are uprisings even in Sudan. That happened because the status quo is not sustainable. But we have also looked at those, and as you say, we've seen anarchy, we've seen the mess that is there. And invariably, it's those who are organized who come to power. If you take Egypt, it's the Muslim Brotherhood, yes, and the army.
Yeah.
They fought it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I don't think in 2007 there was any political leadership, whether it was the opposition itself, you know, that would have led that revolution or that, you know, uprising. And the uprisings, even when Raila became, you know, declared himself the people's, you know, president. You see, if he had brought down Jubilees, you know, in 20 before handshake was what was
handshake was
2000 and was it 2018? Yeah.
It was 2018.
Yeah,
it was 2018.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2018, soon after the 2017 election. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the revolution for me, if you are going to have it, is to, again, to go back to links and continuities and see how we trace it back to Mau Mau, KPU, and if there was a continuation of radical political parties other than just oppositions who could easily be bought, you know. I mean, you saw what happened to Raila's handshake with Moi, where the opposition reinforces the
absolutely, and then they are shocked.
Yeah, I think I would say all African countries can face uprisings anytime, okay? But whether you are going to have an alternative political leadership is the question. Okay, because there are some countries where the military go in as a leadership, and we know what that means.
They just start by suspending the constitution anyway, I mean.
Yes, and the revolution for Kenya, I think it's the one that takes off from the Mau Mau. I mean, if you're going to talk about land and freedom and our resources, it has to be anti-imperialism and actually anti-leaders who are there who don't want that, you know, fundamental change that we are talking about, which is even implementing the constitution, which if it was implemented, it will put us in some kind of a social democratic trajectory, you know, where we caring about issues of education, health, and so forth. The resources are not being stolen or, you know, wasted and so forth. We don't have that, you know.
Absolutely. So the big win for Kenya so far is actually the 2010 constitution.
Yes.
And
you can see, you can say maybe that's what the good man of God foresaw. Because the 2010 constitution is a revolution, a revolution in that sense. Because you know, I think it's Samir Amin and Rodin again, who basically talk about these continuities.
Yeah.
And they get to a particular moment where even if you don't call them a revolution, you can call it a small revolution, if you will. Because it's a watershed.
Yeah.
For serious continuities of struggles and resurrecting others, the way the constitution in its preamble talks about the heroes who fought for our land and freedom, you know, they are recognized, right? And the constitution itself, when you look at the 2010 constitution, has so many sides of struggle, you know. I think we talked about the one on religion.
Yes.
And we have talked about the one on land.
Correct.
We can talk about the one on social and economic and whatever. The whole question of the right to water, foods, you know, security, universal health care, sanitation.
And even, I mean, for me, sometimes, I mean, what I find absolutely, you know, impressive, including, you know, those freedoms, I mean, which one could not even see in the constitution that was, you know, preceded the current constitution. So artistic freedom, scientific freedom, academic
language,
freedom, language, our multi
environment.
Absolutely.
So it remains abstract, but when you look at it, it was a revolution, and we're resisting to have it implemented. People want to betray us. That's how revolutions are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they can happen, And then the gains can be clawed back.
So as we come to the end of our discussion, because I think this is such a powerful reflection. So constitutions sometimes would need to be amended because of changing circumstances and so on.
Yes.
But there are many of us who have felt that tinkering with the constitution of Kenya is dangerous because of the possibility of overreach in terms of the tinkering.
Yes.
Do you carry the same anxieties?
My position is whenever there is an amendment to the constitution, I try to find out who is behind it. Okay? And as long as we don't have a leadership that is committed to implementing the pillars of that constitution and also rescuing the weaknesses. Because we talked about land, all right? And we basically said, you know, is there a weakness? There is, of course, a weakness. Because why do we still continue the principle willing buyer, willing
seller?
Yeah, particularly when we are tracing the whole theft, you know, to the British imperialism. So it depends on, like the BBI, you know, when it did happen.
The Building Bridges Initiative.
Yeah, you could see very, very, very clearly that they were not focused on rescuing the weaknesses. The constitution hadn't been implemented. For heaven's sake, you have even implemented Chapter 6.
Yeah.
Which allows us
integrity.
To get a leadership that can actually implement the, you know, the constitution. So you are right. You had better stay with an abstract document, but that states that we are entitled to certain rights. And it stays that way because it stays as a site for struggle, because it gives us the right to basically say, wait a minute, why should we wait for your progressive realization of economic rights when you are stealing resources, when you are wasting resources and so forth? And the transformative constitution really is great for that purpose. But just creating sites, or you can call them locations, you can call them terrains or bases, where people can start, you know, mobilizing. I mean, look at the gay rights thing. Okay, look at about literary freedom, which we went through with Wanuri and all that. That struggle was helped by the document.
Absolutely.
Because that's where we went back and said, how can you tell a film director that they can't think?
They can't create in a particular
they
way.
They can't create in a particular way.
So technically you're telling them that the movie you created should have been created in a different way.
Yeah.
Therefore, that stifles their imagination completely.
Yeah, and even expression. It's not supposed to be, you know, limited.
It's almost like saying a filmmaker, don't make a film, write a novel.
Yeah.
And yet they want to make a film.
Yeah. So for me, I oppose that tinkering because the tinkering is clawing back. Particularly when it comes from a conservative political leadership that finds the constitution too progressive for their liking. Because they want to steal, they want to waste resources, they don't want to be accountable. So Article 10 for them is crazy. They don't believe in inclusiveness.
Article 10, the national values and principles.
Yes, because there is equality. They don't want transparent and accountability. They don't want human rights. There is a lot of stuff there that they are, you know, very uncomfortable with. If we go by the issue of the two-third gender.
Yeah.
Just that.
Yeah. Okay. Which we have struggled with.
Yeah.
You know, and yet it is such a straightforward constitutional requirement, but they just don't want, even when they can do it at the level of executive.
Yeah.
You know, which is appointive. Yeah. You know.
You see, that's a problem, because you see, until they fulfill, you know, the two thirds. You know, the people work in Kamuru and others who talk of we are the 52%. Marilyn.
Marilyn.
Yeah, you know, they are into that trench, in that terrain, fighting for women's rights because of that article. And nobody can stop them. When you have a very progressive Bill of Rights like the one we have, the media is going to have their own battles if there's going to be any problem there. Soon, the students will start talking about universal education.
Yeah.
I basically say, we the poor are being, and there is a value about protecting the marginalized.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So women, students from poor families.
Indigenous languages, a minority.
And the vision is there. The struggles, continue. And they continue until you have a political leadership that believes that this country needs fundamental change. And there is a document, you can use it to give you that, legitimacy. And that's what I think, until you have that leadership that embraces the vision of the Constitution. Because the Constitution itself, when you look at some of the provisions, it's anti-imperialism in a lot of ways.
No, it's amazing because, you see, you have... you have shown the link between the Constitution and political leadership.
Yes.
Because you have to have a political leadership that is people-centric.
Yes.
That then is able to say, look, we shall implement this Constitution in a manner that protects the people who are sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
And the people actually also trust that leadership.
Yeah.
To do so.
Yeah, because that trust is important. When you go to Article 1, it says the sovereign power, belongs to us.
Yes.
But we can delegate it.
Yes.
And we can withdraw it. Okay?
Yeah.
So what we have been doing is trying to withdraw it. People challenging MCAs and other people are not doing what they are supposed to do. So I get very fascinated with the idea of exercising sovereign power directly. like Article 157, the one that allows we can start a private prosecution, and DP cannot withdraw it without our permission.
Yes, yes.
The history of that was, the Goldenberg case that we tried to prosecute privately, and the Wako came in and withdrew it and didn't prosecute. Now, under that constitution, if you start a public interest, prosecution, criminal prosecution, and that's what the civil society should do with all these withdrawals that have taken place. They are taken back.
Take them back.
Yes, under private prosecution. So
it's public interest litigation.
Yeah. That's the beauty of it. The beauty of it. What is missing is that political element that once somebody like Okoitima Mutata used to go to court on public interest litigation, or Katiba Institute, LRF, and others.
Yes.
Where you then find a political party that comes with them, okay, and actually joins it's interested party.
Mm-hmm.
That's what.
You know, it's interesting because quite often we talk about citizens giving their power to their representatives, but we never talk about residual power. We never talk about
it's in the Constitution now.
Yeah, it is in the Constitution that power is not absolute.
No,
that power the people remain with a residual power, which they can activate.
Yes, and exercise directly.
Exercise directly.
Yeah, it has to be internalized in terms of politics.
Yeah,
what it means. And one area, one site that is important is that one of private, private criminal prosecution, where you tell the state, look, we gave you this delegated power to prosecute these people so that, the money comes back, and you have refused. Then we are doing it directly.
But how do you adduce evidence?
Article 35. That's what I was telling. I was telling the Law Society of Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
Get the files from Noordin Haji.
Yeah.
Say you want the file, as a civil society organization, you want the file so that you can actually see whether the withdrawal was merited. And I don't know whether the withdrawals are absolute or conditional. Because if they are conditional, it means they can be prosecuted even, you know, privately. But if it's absolute, it's going to be difficult. Yeah.
And then, of course, there is the Commission for Administrative Justice,
yes,
which also, you know, which can also access on behalf of the
of
people,
course. Of course.
You know, some of that information.
Mm. For me, I think that the greatest opportunity that Kenya has to come up with an alternative political leadership is now. The opportunity basically to breathe life into these sites, you know, of struggle. But as long as we keep on having leaders who reinforce dictatorships, you know, and governments and so forth, the way Raila did it
with Moi, actually.
And Moi, and then...
And also with Uhuru.
When that happens, then the people should themselves be the rulers in the sense of monitoring the opposition and the government. That delegated power from the opposition should be withdrawn.
Yeah.
Okay? Because it's not monitoring anything.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So any final reflection on this matter? Because I think we have really covered some very good ground historically.
Yeah,
and we have gone on to...
you have discussed, you know,
for
everything.
Instance, I have one last one, you know. Because, you know, when we talked about radical Pan-Africanism and we talked about and we talked about the merits of radical Pan-Africanism.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think there is a certain thrust, and African countries are still making constitutions? Tanzania, you know, is on the way to enacting a new constitution, and there are many other countries.
Gambia was doing it. Parliament shut it down.
Yeah. So do you think there is certain thrust that African constitutions can have to entrench this radical Pan-African idea? Yeah, radical Pan-African,
you know,
idea.
It's a great question, because in the 21st century, we are thinking about Africa in a different way. We're thinking of African currencies. We are thinking of unity in Africa. And I think it's a great question in the sense that we've now start thinking, you know, what the charters will look like. You know, is this AU charter, good enough? Because we know what the leadership is like, you know, African Union. So I think, yes, because this radical Pan-Africanism is about people to people. Then we've got to proactively think of what the institutions that will anchor, you know, that radical Pan-Africanism will look at. And I think it's to borrow the transformative, you know, constitutions that are there. And they start with India. India is a constitution that says in the preamble that they are going to build a socialist economy or socialist society. We can look at India, South Africa, you know, Colombia. There are a lot in the global south that have transformative constitutions. And then, as we are saying in the case of Kenya, we look at where the weaknesses are, so that they are not repeated, you know, in that continental and global charter that will anchor, you know, Pan-Africanism. And I think when you look at radical Pan-Africanism, the leaders of that particular movement, whether we start with Nyerere and Nkrumah, Amilcar Cabral and Gaddafi and Sankara, you know, there is, and even intellect.
Even NASA.
Yeah, because you see, these were the Bandung guys in 55. It was all these countries that later became, called themselves non-aligned.
Correct.
You know, because it's still that debate that the world should not be unipolar. You know, we need a multipolar world where there are forces
from different directions.
Yes, yes. And
because they provide stability.
They do. Because, I mean, the Cold War provided that kind of option for the
balancing of power. I mean, you end up, you minimize excesses when you have singularity of sites of power.
And I think, in fact, that issue is so brilliant that I think those who are involved in reparations, those movements, Black Lives Matter, the whole question of global South transformative constitution, That's what we should think at. How do you rescue these weaknesses we are talking about?
Correct.
You know, so that there are no reversals and, you know, clawing back and so forth.
I think that some of the work could be, of course, in having a very progressive interpretation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a way, in my view, the constitutions could be read to celebrate.
Yeah.
Beyond borders. Eh?
Yeah.
Other than being very insular in terms of.
Yeah.
The nation state, as it were.
Yeah.
And that we reach out, and also providing input.
Yeah.
Beyond borders.
Yeah. When I visited Nigeria in 2015, you know, and saw that their president, I suggested to him and the others whether Nigeria could be, as a big African country, be the one that hosts what I called, you know, a Pan-African, you know, institute for progressive jurisprudence.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what Ghana decides, Nigeria, Malawi, South Africa, and whatnot, there is a coordination so that we stop relying on foreign authorities, you know, and we pick the gems of progressive jurisprudence through those particular institutes. So they said they would think about it. Nothing happened. So at the moment, we're thinking of, you know, the Caribbean, because they are really talking a lot about Pan-Africanism and the reparations and so forth. And then we can bring in that aspect of these constitutions have to be interpreted. What kind of, you know, jurisprudence? Because we have seen now how effective the judiciary is, because it has a final word
on so many issues. It counterbalances the political class, and of course going to the diaspora as a site of deeper reflection and deeper interpretation it actually makes a lot of sense.
Take for example the cases that Mother Karua has been taking to the East African Court of Justice. It's very important that the Supreme Court of Kenya doesn't become an apex court and the last word on everything. So once you go to the African, the continental court, or you go to the East African one, and you go to that Pan-African Institute, if there is, and they critique what you are doing, and the Constitution says you can change your decision, that's how you build that jurisprudence that is African and progressive. Because once you deal with the hierarchy, of course, you can get very bad decisions. The Supreme Court can be actually a graveyard of progressive.
Absolutely,
yes,
absolutely. Depending on who sits there.
Yeah, so it's good to have this notion that you are not final. There's an East African court that can critique you, the African court, and then there's one that is global, you know, for global African that is looking at these things and so forth. And the lawyers will quote all that, you know.
In other words, because societies themselves are always in the making, they are always seeking to improve themselves, we can find answers in the interpretations of the documents that we have, and we can make adjustments. But I think always seeking to be better than we were.
Yeah, you know, one of the decisions we came up with, I think the digital migration case, we basically said that the Constitution gives a theory of its own interpretation, and it discussed the pillars and whatnot, and it's being followed in many ways. That's how judges are coming to the issue of history, you know, economics, theology, and so forth, you know, to deal with certain sections, that the articles that are there. What does it mean that we acknowledge the supremacy of the Almighty God of all creation? Okay, you know,
it's going to be very interesting space now, because the technology world is going into artificial intelligence, and I think that the judiciary must be a learning institution.
There will be artificial Intelligent judges.
There should be artificial intelligence. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. In fact, the Emirates are thinking of such a court in mass in 100 years.
Thank you so much, Chief Justice William Mutunga. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy. It's always such a pleasure having discussions with you.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity for learning for me and also for us to continue, you know, educating each other.
Yeah.
In this journey. So thank you so much.
Anytime. Yeah.
This concludes our episode in our three-part series of this podcast about constitution making in Kenya with Chief Justice Professor Willy Mutunga, President of the Supreme Court of Kenya. Thank you for listening to the Africa Speaking Podcast. Join us in our next episode, brought to you by Treasure Communications. My name is Kimani Njogu. For any comments and views, you can reach us through our website, www.africaspeaking.org. You can also reach us on Facebook, Twaweza Communications, or on our Twitter handle, @TwawezaComs. You can also write to us on email, info@africaspeaking.org.